Michelle.
Connor.
You ready to gut up?
Oh, yeah.
All right, good, because this is the Now a Major Motion Picture Podcast. And today we're talking about World War Z.
So the way this podcast works is I'm Michelle, I'm a librarian, and I read the book, and then I watch the movie.
And I'm Connor. I might have been a film major at one point. I don't know. Can't remember. And I watch the movie, and then I read the book, and then we discuss.
So today we're talking about World War Z by Max Brooks. And in honor of World War Z, we are drinking zombies. Would you like to tell our audience how you make a zombie?
There's a million versions of the zombie. They are basically rum-based drinks.
Okay.
Just look it up. It's on the internet, people.
It's fruity and rummy, and it's delicious, and I am noticing that I'm the only person with ice in my glass, so if you hear the sound, you know that I am drinking.
And to blame, is really.
Yeah, I'm to blame for the failure of this podcast.
Yes.
Often, we say that there are no more new ideas, and obviously we've seen a million zombie movies, and there are horror genre books, but this is really a new look at the way we think about zombies. It's almost like, I am coining a new phrase right now, it's like a zombie procedural. It's like, what would you do? What would the world do if there are zombies? The book reminded me of the movie Contagion, like how, like we're just watching how everyone is going to react. So it's like, how do the pharmaceutical companies react? What were the politics of it? What were the military strategies? There's issues about the media, about the economy. There's race issues, class issues. They even deal with, you know, our celebrity obsession. And it's just every chapter is one person's point of view of how they are viewing the war at a different time. So the chapters are kind of just grouped chronologically, more or less. And it's this one faceless narrator. We don't really know anything about the narrator. And he's just going from place to place all over the world, interviewing people who have survived this zombie war. And in the book, the war takes place, really, we don't exactly know how long it really took, but it seems like it's about a decade.
I think it's saying 12 years.
They say 12 years. So it's about 12 years, and at the end of the book, spoiler, actually everything here is a spoiler, so like
yeah,
everything's going to be spoiled. We're spoiling everything. At the end of the book, even though they've kind of gotten past the worst part of the war, like they're getting back to normal, it's still an issue. There are still zombies, they're still fighting this, but it's now at least controlled and things are trying to get back to the way they were. So that's my summary of the book. I really enjoyed it because I thought it was really interesting and it's really thoughtful. There are a lot of very clever things that go into this book, you know, like they're really thinking about how would pharmaceutical companies act. You know, of course they would come out with a drug that they would think would cure this, and then, you know, would they be responsible enough to make sure that their claims are true? You know, so it's like it's just very clever and very interesting. And like I said, I feel like it really delved into an area that hasn't been thought of yet. You know, no one really ever wrote this kind of a book before. So I was really hoping that the movie was going to be slightly similar to the book. I always say that the book is better, and this time it's not even that.
Did you know where the bread is buttered?
I know where my bread is buttered, because, you know, they'd kick me out of a cute girl with glasses club if I said that the movie was better. But you can't even say that the book is better, because, like, this movie only shares the title of this book. You know, I think there are two things in the movie that happen that are in the book. I mean, besides the obvious that there are zombies. I forgot exactly where I was going with this. Oh, what I expected out of the movie. So I was really hoping it would be either interview-based somehow, or maybe like vignettes, like zombie vignettes, or just something that had the core of this book, because this book is so interesting. And I think it could have been so the movie could have been so much better. Like, the movie doesn't take any risks at all. It's just like action zombie movie. And it could have really gone in a different direction, but it didn't. So it's pretty disappointing with that.
Okay. Okay, I would my best attempt to summarize this mess of a movie. Starts out as one movie where there's a guy who's trying to escape with his family, and it's kind of a road movie, sort of, because he keeps traveling. But then the whole point is he gets a call and he's needed by the government to come out of retirement. And then it becomes a different movie where he goes and he's trying to figure out how to cure this worldwide epidemic. And so I guess it's kind of like at that point it turns into like Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego video game, where he's like gets a question and then he has to go figure out which of these places am I going to, and then he goes there and oh, he found out like that piece of information just left or something, and then he goes to the next place. When I saw it, I was like, this is not a good movie. And then as I thought, well, I mean, I knew the book a little bit. I'd heard about it. I knew the title was Oral History, Zombie War, whatever the exact subtitle was, I forget. But I knew the style was going to be. It's going to be, it was modeled after the Studs Terkel book. So I guess what I thought is the book was going to have pieces of it that were in the movie. Mostly two things I thought were going to be in the movie. I thought the Israel stuff was going to be in the book, which it was. I thought it would be more, a much bigger section in the book than it was. And I guess I thought the ending at the WHO, World Health Organization bit in Cardiff, that was going to be in the book. And I said, it was an oral history, so I figured they were probably just going to try to take like sections of the book and not try to do the whole thing. But no. The thing I thought was actually really strange is I could see, like, oh, this is, like, a really hard movie to make. Then once I read the book, I was like, oh, this, you could have actually done this. The movie's just terrible, basically.
Well, should we maybe talk about for a little bit, I think, as a person who read the book before the movie came out, there was a lot of, you know, talk on the internets that this book is unfilmable. So, and I guess what you're saying is you disagree that this book is not unfilmable, and I would disagree as well. But is this book unfilmable? Connor, go!
No, it is not unfilmable for a few reasons. I think one is you could actually go the route of faux documentary, which would actually be really interesting. I'm not sure the studio behind this would be willing to bankroll that.
Do you think that would get a little, like, comedic? Like, you know, would it go the... Oh, who's that director who makes all those mockumentaries?
Christopher Guest?
Yeah, Christopher Guest. Do you think it would become like a Christopher Guest film?
I don't think it has to be that way. I mean, I think you could sort of have a little bit of fun with it in the sense that it could almost be like a, like one of those like Lifetime movies where you interview people and then there's like dramatic recreations. Except that they'd be...
Dramatization.
Yeah. Except they could be big budget and it would actually be interesting, right? So you could do that. I think another route you could go is... it's actually making me think of the movie Reds, which is... like a 3 hours plus, but it's a really good movie. It gets going. What they do is they intercut it with people who actually knew, like John Reed and such, and some of the other characters in the movie. And so they cut it, and there's actually these interviews. You know, so it's sort of a little bit like looks like what they did in When Harry Met Sally, where they have those old people, except these are old people not talking about nonsense. It's actually talking about like communist organizing in like the teens and 20s. So you could actually do something like that. Like, there's no reason why you can't, like, have some of these interviews, but then also have the interesting, big-budget, sort of action-y scenes they want. In fact, there's actually even some of that stuff in the book, which is also the part that I was surprised by. There's actually some really interesting visuals in the book, so it's not like, oh, this is just people talking in the book, so it would be interesting. Like, there's all sorts of great images in the book that aren't in the movie. Like, the idea of, like, that they get frozen... the zombies and like they actually thaw.
I'm nodding right now, and yes. I just realized that I'm nodding.
Yes. you need like a whoosh sound when you nod. Whoosh, whoosh.
Yeah, because when I nod,
yeah.
That much wind is created.
Yeah, exactly.
From my gargantuan head.
Yeah. So, but there's all sorts of visual stuff. There's the thing of they scribe. I forget if they give them a name, but they're like zombies who've lost the legs and they just crawl.
Yeah, I think they call them creepers.
Creepers. Yeah. There's all sorts of great visual images in this book, and all the great images in the book are none of them are in the movie.
As for scenes in the book, I think, and a million people on the internet have already said that, you know, the Battle of Yonkers is this amazing scene in the book where they actually have, like, a fantastic battle.
It's a kind of a lengthy section of the book.
It's
too.
Quite large.
So there is something you can do with it.
And, I mean, for me, I think it's fantastic because it's so interesting because they're failing. You know, so often when we see a battle scene, it's, you know, it's exciting because, you know, the side that you're rooting for is winning. And they're failing not because they couldn't do it, but just because they're so ill-equipped and ill-prepared. And, you know, we hear these stories about, you know, like the soldiers in Iraq not having the right kind of armor or not having this or not having that. And here you just see a similar situation, but like with zombies. So like, it's so easy to kill them that in the book, they don't run fast. And yet, and that they're so obsessed with technology that they can't do it because they don't have the more basic tools that would just solve this problem quicker.
Yeah, we need to get back to the running fast zombies thing.
Oh, we will talk about fast versus slow zombies.
Yes.
Because it's in my notes.
Okay. No, I think it bears a lot of importance when we get to the film. Yeah, but the thing is, the other thing with reading the book is how much, well, I can't think of the phrase, but how much cross-pollination there is, let's say, of the storytelling, right? That's probably not the phrase I mean, but overlap, that's what I mean, overlap, not cross-fertilization.
Or cross-pollination,
yeah,
which is what you said first.
Yeah, either one of those, clearly. But no, there's a lot of overlap. Like, there's a lot of things referred to in someone's interview that come back to in something else. So there is actually a lot. So even if you were going to film it as these interviews, there is an aspect of, you know, there's a lot of overlap. So you could even condense some of the, I think, stories or interviews, or it would be okay because you'd be referring to things. Like, it'd almost be like a story told a little bit out of order, like Pulp Fiction.
I think in my mind, when I was imagining how this film could be, I was thinking it could be something like the movie Babel. And, you know, maybe there would only be four or five characters that we would follow around, but through those five characters strategically placed around the world, we would get a whole story. Because I think what you're saying with the cross-pollination or whatever.
Slash cross-fertilization slash overlap.
Yeah. That I think one of the things that's really very well done in this book is that Max Brooks really can tell a very complicated story through many characters. It's not linear, and it's really like the holes get filled in. You know, like all the information we need is there, and that's really quite masterful. Good on him that he did such a good job. I only wish the filmmakers had done such a good job.
I find the book interesting in a few ways. One of those, I was trying to sort of figure out what exactly is the voice of the book. Because it is done in the style, even though it's fiction, interviewing these characters. And once we interview them, we essentially leave them. I mean, there's the last chapter where he does some reveal. But basically, we interview people and then we leave them. And occasionally you get references to them, like, I forget the guy's name from South Africa, like Darkard. Like,
the guy who makes the plan.
Yeah, and
the Rediker plan.
Rediker, yeah. And it keeps being referred to in footnotes, which actually, I listened to a little bit of the audiobook this morning, too, and one of the unfortunate things about audiobook, obviously, is you miss all the footnotes.
Oh, they don't.
So there's all these references in footnotes to that plan, right? Like, this is the German plan, but it's the Chinese plan, but so you miss all those footnotes in the audiobook, which is a problem.
Well, back to what you were saying about the voice of the book.
Yes.
I think it's very interesting that there is no, there's really no narrator of the book. There's no one protagonist. You know, the person who's doing these interviews very rarely interjects himself inserts himself into the story just to give a very brief description at the beginning of each chapter of who's talking. And then maybe he asks a couple questions, but besides that, he really is just not in the story. So what I think was really interesting is that the author really creates very unique voices in each portion. In each interview, I felt like each person had a distinct voice. And I think that's a job well done, because I have no idea how many unique interviews there are in the book. I didn't count that. But, you know, it's got to be like 50? I don't know, probably more. I don't know, but it's a lot of different interviews, and I feel like each one has a distinctive voice. And that's, you know, again, good on him for being an excellent writer.
So this poses an interesting question, is what exactly is the voice of the book? It's a little hard to discern what the Brooks is trying to say at times, because he is giving voice to all these different characters. Like, he's giving voices to people who are regular people, people in armed forces, people in government, you know. And it seems like the only time maybe there's really an idea is when, as let's say he is represented by the interviewer, he really presses people. Like the guy who does Phalanx, which is something not touched upon in the movie, which is this essentially this, I think it's called a vaccine.
I think it was a vaccine that was
yeah.
supposed to protect you from becoming a zombie.
Yeah. So, and basically it didn't work in short. So he, like the interview sort of really grills him, whereas a lot of other people, interviewer sort of just lets them go. I actually kind of enjoy the book more when people just have a talk without being interrupted by the interviewer. Actually, I think some of the interviewer questions sort of break up the flow a little bit. I don't enjoy it as much as people sort of just talking. Like, I find it a little awkward sometimes. I also find it, I don't know if this is a little thing of he got worried about him being, will he be considered an author? Because the book he wrote before this wasn't exactly a novel either. But he does this thing of like,
Well, obviously he's an author.
Yeah, no, but, okay, yeah. No, but I mean,
it's not like there actually was a zombie war, which he then did interviews for and transcribed them.
Oh, well, okay. My interpretation of everything is totally different now that you've informed me. Okay. Now I got it. Rearranging pieces in my head. No, but there's this thing of, like, someone is talking, right? And they're just sort of talking. And there's a certain way you transcribe that, right? But then there'll be, like, these bracketed things of, like, coughs. Like, shuffles his hands in a way that just...
Yeah, well, those, like, kind of the stage directions
yeah,
in the book are unnecessary.
Yeah, and that's why I wonder, what I mean when I say, like, I wonder if you got a little nervous about will he be considered, like, a novelist, if he just sort of does, like, these sort of bits. Like, does he sort of have to put it in the sort of flowery language or whatever you want to call it?
I don't know. It didn't bother me, but now that you're mentioning it, and I'm looking back, yeah, that was unnecessary.
Yeah, and it's even
but
more
his
awkward
the questions, oh, sounds bad.
Yeah, so actually, that was the one thing I didn't like with the way it was written, of actually the, so the sort of bracketed bits, where it's almost like it becomes novel-y, for lack of a better word, when he does that. And I sort of just like the flow when people just speak uninterrupted by the interviewer. It almost makes me wonder if might have been even a value to the book of it just being a collection of primary documents, quote-unquote, and then there could be other things, like there could be diary entries, there could be newspapers from the times, like, does it just have to be this guy collecting information?
I think, you know, that's interesting, that's a different book. You know, I enjoyed it as the interviews. I didn't have a problem with him inserting himself into the interview. Now that you mentioned it, the little stage directions are annoying. I think we should maybe talk about a couple things that are in the book that aren't in the movie, which is everything in the book, but just a couple main things, and then maybe go into movie bashing. I forgot the name.
The section is not movie bashing. We're talking about the movie.
Okay, I know, but because we both dislike the movie in our notes, I wrote movie bashing. But, and, you know,
okay. Well, I'm sticking up for the movie.
Are you going to stick
as a concept, not
okay.
the product itself.
I think we should talk about a couple more things that are in the book and not in the movie, and then move over to our more in-depth discussion of the movie. I forgot the name of this. I could look it up in the book, but you were talking about Phalanx, which is the drug that is supposed to be a vaccine against zombies. There's also something in the book that I thought was really interesting from a like psychological standpoint, where the people that pretended to be zombies... Do you remember the name? It's like, Quisling.
Quizzards.
What?
Quizzards?
Quislings.
Quizzlings.
Quizzlings.
All right.
Thanks.
Well, that one out.
So then there's another thing that does not appear in the movie at all, which is really interesting, that there are these people called Quislings who just somehow either mentally give up or feel that it's better to, you know, if you can't beat them, join them, so just become a zombie. So they act like zombies, and they actually bite people, and they, like, walk in that stilted way. And it was because of those Quislings that people actually thought that Phalanx, the vaccine, was successful, because people would be bitten by a Quisling and then survive. So I just thought that was another interesting thing that was totally
interesting. Well, it's an interesting idea, but it's also interesting because when you find out the thing about, oh, that's why people thought it worked, you find that out way later in the book. Like, there's an interview with the Phalanx guy really early, and then later on, there's a guy, I think it's like neighborhood security or something.
He's saying the Quislings are such a danger.
Yeah, and so the book trusts you to use your brain because you are not a zombie. Unlike the movie, where we'll get to this later on, but there's a scene where they... you visually see everything that's happening, and then these scientists, these very smart people, literally tell you everything that's happening on the screen multiple times.
Save it.
But it does also sort of pose the question to me, well, what exactly is the book trying to say? Because there's some interesting stuff, like the section on Israel I found very strange from a historian's perspective. The idea that, like, they decided to open up their borders and they're letting in people who aren't infected who are Palestinian, when the entire history has been building walls and taking over other people's lands. Very strange.
As a Jewish person who is not a Zionist, I did find that really odd, because to me it was almost like, we always have to paint Israel in the most positive of lights. So here we have a fictitious Israel that, one, is the only country on Earth that takes this threat seriously and decides to, like, seriously act immediately. And, you know, if the...
And justifies all of its previous thinking, too.
Yeah. I thought... And actually, that's one of the two things that's in the book, in the movie and the book, is the idea of the tenth man.
Yeah.
Which is much better explained in the book than in the movie. But the idea is that because Israel has, and the Jews in general, have had so many times when they're, you know, are almost, you know, put into extinction, that they're not going to take anything for granted. And if nine people agree on something, the tenth person has to disagree. So I thought that was interesting.
Of this more or less secret information government order. Yeah, I'm just saying, it's not just like 10 random people.
Oh, no, not 10 random people. 10 people who are in power, who are the ones who are deciding how to evaluate.
Yeah, they're not like conducting street polls with 10 people.
Okay, I don't think that anyone thought that, but thank you for clarifying. So, you know, on the one hand, first, Israel is the only person, the only country that takes this threat seriously. They're like, okay, well, we'll just go with it and do the most drastic plan there is. And if it turns out that this zombie thing isn't real, whatever, you know, so on the one hand, they're the only ones who take it seriously. And then they just go back on everything they've ever done historically and then decide it's just open borders for anyone who isn't infected, and specifically reaching out to Palestinians and Arabs saying, yes, you're welcome to come into Israel, which they've never done before. And,
well, the polar opposite.
And the polar opposite is true. Hence, why there is such, such a conflict, you know, for thousands of years in the Middle East. So, yes, that was a little strange in the book.
But the thing that's really interesting is after you read that, it's kind of a lengthy section of the book. There's this next section, and it sort of deals with. There's essentially, we should call it, uprising of, like, really right-wing particular sect of Hasidic Jews, right? And that's actually a really interesting part of the book, because it's sort of saying, and that's sort of what made it the Israel crumble. And then I was sort of wondering, is this actually what one of the things Max Brooks is trying to say about Israel, right? It's like, you can't just, because Israel has, in terms of who's been in the government, moving further and further to the right since the 70s, is this actually a thing of, you know, it's a little bit made me think of, is it, like, this is how he used the question of Israel, like, you can't just keep going to the right, or else it's all going to implode. Because he does have this thing in there, in the book, he says, well, they had moved back to prior, I think, the 67 borders, because they had actually lost. Israel was sort of retreating, because, and so as a result of that, there was a certain right-wing, like, small section of the populace that was trying to not accept the changes coming in. And it just sort of made me think, like, oh, is this how Brooks sees, like, this is a question of the Mideast? Like there has to be some type of two-state solution. There has to be, like, some type of element of compromise. You can't just sort of be unrelenting, like, right-wing zealots, you know? Because there's also other elements that sort of seem to be about other elements of compromise and meeting, like, halfway in other parts of the book as well.
Well, I think, you know, on the one hand, he does paint Israel in a very friendly, open-minded way that is not how they are. But then the overall message is, yeah, we have to put aside our differences and work together. And I think that idea is present in the book many times. And it's really interesting. Like, for example, there's with Israel where they let everyone in, and the movie is a bit different because in the movie it crumbles, and in the book it I don't believe that they...
Well, the thing that sort of survives, their plan works. But the problem with in the book is Israel begins to fall apart a little bit, but not completely.
In the movie, it sort of becomes unstable
a bit because of this uprising. But also, the thing that makes clear in the book is these ultra right-wing sects where people, because they were part of like this ultra-Orthodox sect, they actually never had to serve in the army, which is what's required for people in Israel. So that actually the uprising was put down. It was unstable. The country was unstabilized by it, but it was actually put down. Leaving aside the reality of like, oh, let's just start letting Palestinians in after we've been bulldozing their houses, there's a weird thing in the movie. I just gotta say this in the book part because it's a comparison of like they start letting Palestinians in, and they're clearly Palestinians because they're waving the Palestinian flag as they're coming through. And
there's
singing
a clear
song.
Division between who's Jewish and
yeah.
who's Palestinian when they're in the movie
because they're at the line. Yeah.
And if you're
on the run from zombies and trying to. Like get in, you're definitely bringing a little novelty-sized Palestinian flag to wave.
Of course, as well as a kind of little handheld microphone with, you know, little mini-speaker that you will then be singing songs of joy into while you're waiting to go through the line of, you know, guard dogs, and that will ultimately lead to your demise.
Yeah, well, because they're celebrating finally unity, finally they're together, and then they get on the mic and... It echoes, and then the zombies are losing their shit, and they climb the wall, and then they go over. And like so clearly, this idea of a two-state solution is just not feasible, according to the movie.
Yeah, Hollywood's not ready. But what I was going to say is the idea of people coming together comes in other parts of the book as well, like when they're talking about de-stress. And it's almost like this kind of, WPA kind of a program of, you know, everybody getting together and, you know, finding skilled labor. And I thought that was really interesting, the idea of, like, there's no more skilled labor, like, nobody can do anything, and these kind of class issues of...
Well, they do say that, but they're all immigrants, and they're all, like, people living in these ghettos.
Well, that's what I was going to say, was that, like, people who are making huge amounts of money are completely useless, and
F6
then...
F6 or whatever they call it.
Yeah, F6, and then... They wind up being trained. There's like a one woman who winds up being trained by her own maid, you know, in order to help with the war effort. So I thought that was really interesting. And then there are interviews later where someone's like, you know, I used to be an executive, but then I wound up working with de-stress, and I was, I don't know, like digging latrines. That was the most useful thing I've ever done in my life, you know. So that. There is this kind of, like, message that we rely too much on technology and it's not always going to help us, and that really we need to come together to do things that are meaningful.
You used to actually do something productive as opposed to just sort of being people, sort of doing all stuff on computer and just moving around finance and sort of juggling numbers and sort of making fake jobs, right? As opposed to real jobs where people made things.
Yeah, well, jobs where, you know, people tell you what they do and you don't understand because it's completely in the abstract. There's nothing tangible about their job.
He actually does compare it to like Roosevelt in the New Deal and talks about it. And he actually even has the character be someone who used to be a Wall Street person who then moved towards this and actually understood the idea of importance of collectivization. And there's some really interesting ideas in here. And it sort of actually puts things in an interesting context. And it's sort of, I haven't actually read any interviews with Max Brooks on this book, but now I'm sort of interested to. But I doubt any of the interviewers asked him the relevant questions. One of them is I'd really like to know what he thinks about that section of the book, because part of it is it's actually casting things in a light that people aren't used to, and that's part of the point of the book, right? It's like people had, especially like in that section, people, like U.S. people, had this whole middle class life ripped out from underneath them. They sort of couldn't not deal with it, not even saying anything about people above the middle class, like the upper class, right? And so they had to have, like, attuned themselves to this whole new life. And people who could do something were actually now valued over people who couldn't. And the whole society had been turned upside down. People were sort of forced to become re-educated. And it's interesting that that word is used in that chapter without any hesitation or defensive. The idea that people need to be re-education. Whereas now, if you use that, it's such a bad euphemism for some type of totalitarian regime, right?
Yeah.
But it is actually re-education. People had to be re-educated. In the most literal sense, it is a true description, right? Like, this is actually my question for you. This is, I'm a little thrown by. When is this book set?
I feel like this book is set right now. You know, it doesn't, I don't think it has years.
Here's my question, because basically the period where it discusses sort of the zombie war.
Because they seem to have all the technology that we have right now, maybe a little bit more, because towards the end of the book they talk about people on a space station. But it does seem like it's just right now. It's like everything that we have right now, they have in the book, there's no advanced technology, and it doesn't seem to be in the past.
Well, here's my question. Okay, so the book came out in 2006, but it talks about, like, sort of, this is after, like, the 12 years of war of the zombie. So is that mean, like, the zombie war started in 1994?
No, I mean, first, they wouldn't have had, you know, the internet. But I don't think they're supposed to... Well, they wouldn't have had it the way that they're talking about it now.
So this is where I think the book is a little confusing for me. Or maybe it's all there and I dismissed it, because there's elements...
I think you're thinking about the book way too literally.
Well, I'm just saying, they do say it's 12 years in the beginning. But there's weird elements, like they'll say something like mini-disc players. And you're like, what?
I highlighted that, like why there were mini-disc players.
And they talk about like Jamie Lynn Spears, who I think is like Britney Spears' sister. I was like... Nobody listens to that.
I missed that reference because I don't know who Jamie Lynn Spears is. But I was wondering about the mini disc players. But then also in that country, I feel like that was, you know, like an Eastern Bloc country.
But
and it's like, oh, maybe
they don't make mini disc players, and they haven't for a long time. So it doesn't matter if, like, oh, we get this technology later. If they don't make those products, it makes no point. So that's why I was a little confused, because there's also this thing of, I believe they have this description of a soldier where he talks, and he has, like, his eyepiece, and you can do all this stuff in his eyepiece, like, you can get, like, reconnaissance and maps, and like, oh, maybe you can do that now.
Yeah, but that's, like, those Google glasses.
Well, that's why I was a little confused, like, is the movie, is the story set in the future or in the present, and is it alternate past that was a zombie past?
Maybe the book is set 12 years from right now. Because to me, it feels like at the beginning of that war, they were right where we are now. They have everything that we have right now. And then, of course, nothing would have progressed.
2018.
I guess.
Okay.
Because nothing has progressed since they've been in this war, and they couldn't really create anything. So that would kind of make sense. Like, whenever you read this book, it happens right now. The war starts right now, and then it's 12 years in the future that you're reading the book. So,
all right, well, we should probably move on.
This is, like, super long.
So, before we move on to the movie, you would recommend the book?
I think the book is fantastic. I think it's a really interesting read. It's really thoughtful. If you like zombies, it's an interesting take on zombies. I am not actually a huge fan of zombies, but I just think that, as I said, the zombie procedural, you know, how would people react? And there's just so many different aspects. You know, there's society, there's media, there's politics, there's the army. There's just so many different things woven into it. It's really, you know, it's not just a zombie book. Yeah, let's just jump into what I would like to call movie bashing, but I know you don't want to.
No, because I'm going to try, well, we'll get to the contest at the end, but I'm going to try to pick movies, books, where I think the movie's better in the future.
Okay. Connor, bore us with the details of the movie.
Okay, World War Z, 67% on Rotten Tomatoes, far too generous.
This is very generous.
It made about $540 million worldwide. I believe that makes it Brad Pitt's most successful movie ever. We're considering how many good movies he's been in, it's very depressing.
He was in Babel, wasn't he?
Yes, which actually I don't like, but you do. So.
I liked it.
Yeah.
I would say that I typically enjoy the films of Brad Pitt. I think he's usually pretty good and picks good films. Not one of them.
All right, so a few more things. There was a bidding war to get the rights to this book. Brad Pitt's Plan B managed to win the bidding war against DiCaprio's production company. Brad Pitt's company, Plan B, paid over $1 million for it. Which is why when you see the movie, there's five fucking beginnings to the movie.
I'm glad you brought this up, because when Plan B is the first one that comes up, and I was like, oh, isn't that interesting? This is their Plan B for, like, how to fight zombies. And then, like, four more production companies came up.
Production companies.
Yeah, and then I was like, oh, Plan B has nothing to do with zombies. I was confused.
All right. A few other things. We'll talk about Matt Brooks's other two books, which are basically how to survive a... It's like a survival manual. I forget the exact name of it. But it has also been optioned.
Will it... You know what? I would love to see that option.
Zombie survival. I believe that's
yeah,
the correct name.
I would like to see that option, but kind of like the safety video at the beginning of a flight. Like, in full earnestness, just give me tips on what to do in a zombie.
I believe it's also... I haven't read it, but...
It's kind of like Zombieland, though, with,
yeah,
like, how
that,
the rules.
I wonder if it will work, because Zombieland's been done, but...
And Zombieland, I have to say, really good. Really enjoyed Zombieland.
You know, for someone who doesn't like zombie movies, you've done nothing but praise zombie movies so far.
I have not praised... First of all, I have not praised World War Z. Second...
Oh, that's true. You only praised the book.
Yeah, I praised the book. And I think Zombieland is probably... Well, Zombieland and 28 Days Later, I would say, are my favorite zombie movies.
Yeah, well, we're
going
to have to talk about 28 Days Later.
Later. But those are probably the two zombie movies I like.
Yeah. All right, and his other book is apparently... It's a spin-off of Zombie Survival that I think it's called Recorded Text. I haven't looked at it, but apparently it's some, like, described to text, I guess. I mean, I think they made a comic book out of it, too. But either way, those have been... optioned as well. Apparently, they're going to make a movie out of each one of those, which, as I understand, Zombie Survival Guy is supposed to be somewhat comedic, which makes somewhat sense, given the nature of it. But they're also making a World War Z 2, which is already annoying, because all my notes where I've written World War Z look like World War II anyway, so now I'm going to have these to say World War Z.
Mine too, yeah. It's hard.
So
you need a little line through the middle.
They're going to... supposedly make, because it's, I guess, a success, they're going to make a sequel to, from a movie that really had nothing to do with the first book, so I don't even, like, it's almost weird, like, I can under, like, this.
So it's like Ocean's 12.
Continue.
It's a sequel to something that was, okay, so Ocean's 11 was a film done, I don't know, back in the 60s with the Rat Pack. And then they made a new updated version. And then that updated version was so successful they decided to make a sequel, but there was actually no sequel to the original.
Yeah, I but that, it's its own
Ocean's
entity.
12.
Yeah, but the thing is, the new Ocean's 11 establishes itself as its own thing. Like, this movie really makes no sense, which we'll get to in a minute, but... Just a few
I'm
more,
really waiting till
yeah, just a few more things.
The
third act was rewritten by Drew Goddard.
The third act of this film?
Yeah.
Huh.
Drew Goddard was one of the writers of the third act, who I have much love for, Buffy and Angel.
So does that mean that he would have rewritten the part where they're in...
B-Wing. Yes, B-Wing.
Because that's probably the best part of the film.
It is, but we'll get into the thing of... Drew Goddard was one of those people who also did Cabin in the Woods, who I like a lot.
Oh, that was good.
But the other person who co-wrote with him is someone who I cannot stand, who is Damon Lindelof, Mr. Lost.
Oh, and I have a Lost problem.
Yes, you do. And adapted Cowboys and Aliens to the screen. And Prometheus, which is terrible. And Star Trek Into Darkness, which is the sequel. Which, the first one's actually pretty good.
I really enjoyed the first one. The sequel was just...
So apparently people are like, this guy is who we need to call for
a
third act.
He's awesome.
The man who couldn't end Lost, this is who we need to call in for a third act.
Well, nobody could end Lost.
Well, this is why I will give Drew Goddard a pass, because he also worked on Lost, but he left after the fourth season.
Well... That's probably two seasons too late, but whatever.
But he might have thought there was an ending in that show somewhere. Okay, and regardless, we will move on.
Okay.
To the actual movie.
Let's just start from the beginning.
Okay. Title sequence. Useless.
Okay, here's the thing. I would have enjoyed the
title
sequence.
But we've already complained about Five Production Company. So we hate the movie before it begins.
I didn't hate the movie.
No,
I was just like, huh?
Yeah, no, I shouldn't say I hate it. It's just
from
dumb.
The beginning.
It's a dumb movie.
Yeah, it's not the
it's
worst
not even
film.
Terrible. It's a dumb movie.
I mean, honestly, it is entertaining. Like, I wasn't bored through the film. It was bad. Anyway,
I will get into why I disagree.
The opening sequence, I like the idea. It actually kind of It has nothing to do with Shaun of the Dead. My God, I've seen a lot of Paul zombie movies.
Do you like that one, too?
I did like that one.
See, you're a zombie
lover.
Oh, my
God, do I like zombies?
I have a zombie groupie.
Oh, my God, I didn't know. Are you undead?
Well, I am very pale.
You are.
And kind of emotionless.
Oh, my God, I'm married to a zombie.
Yeah, probably.
Okay. In Shaun of the Dead, one of the funny parts of it for me was, in the beginning, he's walking through his daily life, you know, he's going to work, he's getting his coffee, whatever, and there are zombies around him, and he doesn't notice, and it's like a little bit of
Can I interrupt you?
No.
I gotta interrupt you on this.
Okay.
With that one scene, Shaun of the Dead has already had a much more deep political statement than the entirety of World War Z, the movie.
Okay, fair enough. I agree. So, I really liked that in that movie, it's like, oh, isn't it funny? People are going through the mechanisms of life, and it's just, they might as well be undead, because what they're doing is so mindless. In the opening news sequences, I thought it was almost like that, because it's like, they're talking about these beached whales, and these environmental issues, and they're talking about this virus, or rabies, and it's like, it is the message that there could be zombies, and even in the news cycle, you wouldn't even see it. So for a second, I thought that was interesting, but then it culminated to nothing, because we have no idea where we are. We have no idea what knowledge, you know, Brad Pitt and his family, what knowledge they have, because there's this news sequence. They say something about martial law, but as a family, they do not seem upset at all. Like, if martial law was declared in our city, we would be upset.
And he's supposed to be someone that should be.
Well, yes, he has a... Even though we never understand what his job is, he
is
someone...
You know who I am, and you know what I do.
No, I don't.
No.
And he said that towards the beginning... towards the end of the film. Like, it's the last 30 minutes of the film. You know who I am, and you know... what I do. I have no fucking clue what you do.
He's an expert on the ground. I know. But here's the thing, right?
He's the expert on the ground.
I mean, I'm not a filmmaker, but it always annoys me that we need to have opening sequences with... I always get a little joy in my heart when I see a movie and it immediately goes in the movie without an opening title sequence. And so... But the thing is, I will accept that there's kind of this cliche in Hollywood that if you're going to do a title sequence for a movie... like futuristic or something, you do a title sequence where you do a lot of news reports and you give all this exposition, you catch people up. So as soon as the title sequence is over, boom, we get going.
The title sequence tells us nothing.
Nothing.
About what they know. Because the only thing that's of interest is that, and they use the term rabies at one point, which is kind of a throwback to the book, because in the book they mention that people called it African rabies at the beginning. But...
Which one is more political interest? Because there's this whole idea of it being something foreign, and it's like the xenophobia in the book. And
yeah,
stuff.
But in the movie, it's not a cause for alarm. They say that there's martial law, and then this little girl's like, "Daddy, what's martial law?"
Which made me cringe when I heard that.
Well, a child would ask that because they don't
know.
But the fact that they're not upset is ridiculous. Like, if people would be really fucking upset if martial law was declared. Where they live. That's, like, I've never been anywhere where martial law was declared. So even after September 11th, we're in New York, martial law wasn't declared. So, like, that shit's serious. And here they are making their pancakes, having the most mundane conversation, and we just have no understanding of where we're at. The point of that news sequence should be to tell us where we're at right now. And we have no fucking clue. So why did that new sequence exist? And throughout the film, I feel like...
Yeah, like
no
it has this stuff with the dolphin. Which actually reminds me, there's another great image from the book, which is not in the movie, which is the idea of... I think it's early in the book, the idea of when people get sick on boats, they throw them overboard, and they think that's how it spread, is the zombies didn't need to breathe.
Hmm.
So, like really early on, there's the guy who goes and gets bitten in the water.
Can we talk about zombie turn time?
Okay, we will in a second, but, like, why are they showing the dolphins? Because there's nothing in the movie about, like, zombies being thrown overboard.
Well, it's like they almost... Well,
and there's nothing about...
Zombies don't kill animals.
Yeah, and the zombies have no... and there's actually... And then you know this because in the book, people interact with animals. And you actually know that none of them are infected. I'm specifically thinking of the monkey who pees in the guy's face, but maybe that's just me.
Just like a monkey peeing in the guy's face. For example, who was it? That British guy... Chris Morgan.
Oh, yeah, he's on it.
Yeah. There's a scene with him talking about the environment and CO2 levels.
Is he sort of denying global warming?
He's just talking about CO2 levels, and it's almost like, oh, are they going to bring some sort of environmental aspect into this? Like, maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe because we're ruining the environment so much, zombies happen to, like, kill us off? But, like, no, there's no link to that. There's no reason why any of that is in the film. Blech. All I know is that girl has amazing socks. Like, why is that in the news?
Well, I almost wondered if that was dealing with some of, like, the consumerism of the point, because there's elements of that in the book, but then when you watch the movie, it's like, oh, the movie isn't that deep. So, that isn't that. It's just random news shit. Like, I almost felt like it was someone with ADHD, like, just turning through, like, the TV channel.
Which would be really great
if
the...
Of course,
if,
I have
if
this image
the
of someone from the 80s
who
actually
useful.
Had to turn the knob. I don't know why they wouldn't be turning their clicker.
Why would they... In what world do they have a knob? Like,
first of all,
nobody even listens to radio, and they don't even have a knob for that.
In the world where they listen to mini disc players. That's the world I envision.
I have to hit the next button on my mini disc player, and please, nobody stomp or make any shaking vibrations, because it'll distract my mini disc player.
I can't believe it. I'm about to stand up for mini disc players. There wasn't a problem with mini disc players. You could run with mini disc players.
I never had a mini disc player. I had a Discman, and it
oh, no,
was
no, yeah,
it
no, they
was
were
very
much
fragile.
Better in that regard. But the problem is they didn't sound as good as this CD player, so there was no future for them, because they weren't, like, portable enough. Well, I'm not going to get into the demise of the mini disc player. That is a waste of time.
Can we just talk about laser discs?
Okay, moving on.
Okay, should we talk about the misrepresentation of asthma or reanimation time?
You get the asthma out of the way because you know more about health issues than I do.
I am a very allergic person. I do not suffer from asthma, so I am not an expert. But I did have, like, childhood asthma. And as far as I know, asthma is not triggered by stress. Like, asthma is a condition in which you have allergies and your allergic reaction is that you can't breathe. And
She has an asthma panic attack slash thing.
Yeah, but if you're having a panic attack, you can't take an inhaler for it. Like, inhaler's not going to help you with your panic attack because it's mental. It's like your brain is telling your lungs, don't breathe, we're panicking. But I'm going to bring it back.
Speaking of bringing it back, just mention one thing about the opening title sequence, because I just remember this.
Yes. What?
There's all this footage of nature films of animals killing other animals, too. Which has nothing to do with anything. Remember that there's, like a cheetah taking down, I don't remember, a zebra or a yak or something?
Cheetah takes down a yak, and the dead might be walking.
Well, actually, I just realized that's not possible based on geography, a cheetah taking down a yak. But, you know, like, a cheetah's taking down something.
Can I bring it back?
Bring it back.
I am bringing it back to Hand That Rocks the Cradle with Jessica de Mornay.
That was quite the talking piece for the year 1993.
Yes. That was one of the first films that annoyed me about their representation of asthma, where somebody is just freaking out and then they have an asthma attack, which is, like, not how asthma works. And then they're like, oh, I need my inhaler because I'm freaking out. And it just annoyed me that this girl is, like, freaking out because she's scared and having asthma, and, like, that's not asthma. You know, is she allergic to something? Like, does she, what?
She's allergic to
She's like zombies, maybe. And then, my favorite thing is they're trying to calm her down, and they're like, breathe through your nose. Asthma is in your lungs. If you breathe through your mouth, or if you breathe through your nose, the air needs to go to your lungs. It does not matter if you are breathing through your nose, or if you're breathing through your mouth. Like, you just are using both of those orifices to get air into your lungs.
I want to talk about something off of that point, which is, there's two aspects that come to mind.
Why do kids always have to have asthma? Like, there are other problems.
Yeah, like, just having a kid in a zombie apocalypse is enough of a problem. Like, you don't need to, like, up the stakes. I mean, why wasn't she in a wheelchair?
Maybe she should have had polio.
Yeah, perhaps. And blind.
You know what? I just don't want to make any disparaging remarks against anyone who might have had polio. It's just, I'm not against
polio. So for all you 95-year-olds out there, we're not saying anything about polio. So his daughter, who's blind in a wheelchair with polio, and with asthma, But it does bring to mind two things, which is, okay, so we set up this thing of she is going through some type of unique disease.
Where stress
asthma
induces,
panic.
Yeah.
Asthma panic.
Manic.
We're just going to call it asthma panic from now on. So she's suffering from asthma panic. So they have to go to find a pharmacy where they go and get...
Also, like, in what world do they live in? Like, they don't have a prescription.
Well, that is not the issue, because they go into a...
Well, they don't know that it's going to be looted. They're just like, oh, let's just go to the pharmacy. It's like, okay.
I think, of all the problems in the film, I have none with that.
I think it's very important that people need to have a prescription.
This is a problem with someone who's a librarian. So much about rules and order. Like, it's going to be okay. They're going to figure something out. This is extenuating circumstances.
How many inhalers has she had this month? Because I'm sure that her insurance company limits the number of inhalers that she's allowed to have per month.
Okay, buzzkill. Getting back to film. So we established that, right? So then they need to go to the pharmacy. And then we have a pharmacy scene. So we're establishing things in the beginning of the film. That kid is sick. The other one needs her blankie, which gets on my nerves. I've never heard a kid say, I need my blankie. It's like a trope that I've never actually heard in the real world.
This is such a, like, a movie, TV thing that is, like, attachment to a blanket. I've never met a person. Maybe I just don't.
Well, to be fair, they're not going to be adults who have this.
Well, I obviously I'm an adult now, but even as a child, I never met someone who's, like, attached to their blanket. In regards to the pharmacy looting scene, I do think one thing that was done very well in that scene was when that Brad's wife is attacked. And we don't exactly know why she's being attacked by other people in the pharmacy.
Kind of seems like they're trying to rape her.
Yeah,
really
which,
weird.
Like, is the pharmacy why? Why in the pharmacy? The lighting is awful. No one looks attractive. Anyway, Brad Pitt winds up...
Are you going down the alley if she asked for it?
No, if anything, she would have looked her worst.
Okay, I'm just saying, the implication then being, like, then people who look good, possibly,
all I'm
are
saying
asking for it.
Is that the lighting in a pharmacy, not flattering, not sexy, doesn't really make, you know, it's not like mood lighting, it's not ambient lighting. Just saying. Point is... That scene, I really like how Brad Pitt shoots and probably kills someone.
Yeah,
in the aisle of a pharmacy. And then there's a policeman and he holds up his hands like he's going to get arrested. And then the policeman goes and takes, I think it's baby food or...
Yeah, that's one of the three things the film does that's clever.
No, I thought that was a good moment.
But it is just a weird thing because it's interesting, like reading the book... There's these elements of complete and utter depravity. Also elements of, like, heartwarming, like, bravery, right? And this is just sort of, like, savagery in the movie. Like, you get nothing other than really savagery. There's, like, no real human hope in this movie. And as I'm wondering, like, you know, we're... You know what? This is the time we're gonna rape this woman. Like, aisle 7 of the pharmacy. I can't really get in the mind of a rapist, but it's a very strange thing what's going on right there. I'm not entirely even convinced they're trying to rape her. I'm just really confused what's going on.
Do not understand why the little girl wound up being propelled across
aisle. Yeah, like, she could be abandoned, but it's like, you know what, we're going to rape...
In the cart.
We're going to rape this woman, but first, we're pushing this kid all the way down the aisle.
Yeah, because she's like, woo!
But here's the thing, right? We're establishing things. This is still early in the movie, right? So we're establishing the girl has asthma panic. They go to the pharmacy. They have this stuff. They have this bad situation.
Also, her asthma is cured as soon as
she actually never needs the medicine.
Yeah, as soon as they get to the apartment, like, she's fine now.
Which is actually way more scary.
Yeah.
But
even, like, she's on the boat, you know, the Navy ship. Let's move on.
I just gotta say a few things. Because we're establishing a movie, right? We're
never gonna get through this.
Possibly. but here's the thing, right? Like, the first act, you're establishing all these things. And then they go to the apartments. They're in Newark, right? So they go to the apartments. But then, like, they go to a roof. I'm skipping a few things here, obviously. But they go to a roof and they get airlifted. Okay, so none of that shit before made any difference because now it's a different movie. Like, once they get on the Navy vessel, and then it becomes a completely different movie, which is really strange because the one thing when I was watching this movie, I was like, okay, they have this little house scene which establishes some stuff. It's kind of dumb, but I was like, I'll let it slide. I didn't know how dumb it was at the time. But there's just some clumsy exposition. That's why I say it was dumb. I forget how exactly it comes up, but it's always like, Daddy, do you miss your job? He's like, no.
No, actually, he doesn't say no. He takes this long pause, which lets us know that he does kind of miss it, even though it's completely contradicted by what happens later. And
well,
then he's like, I like my new job of driving you to school, or something like
that. And also, how long has he been out of his job? Because why would a child ask that, unless it was very recently? But then later, when, you know, they're trying to pull him back in, he seems like, oh, no, I'm retired, you know, I don't do this anymore.
We'll
and it's like, if he doesn't do this anymore, then why is his daughter asking
We'll get to the Navy ship in a minute. I'm just going to say, like, and so that's the first scene, right? Them in the house. And the second scene is they're in the street driving, and then the shit hits the fan. So I'm watching this movie, I'm thinking, oh, you know what? There's no real scientific explanation for zombies, so you just fucking go for it. And I'm like, all right, I'm on board for this movie, because I'm assuming, because I haven't read the book, the titles, the opening sequence with the titles, that's going to give us all, that's all sorts of information we're going to use later, right? That's what I'm assuming. And then we see this little scene with, like, clumsy exposition, blah, 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 but we're getting out of the way. And I'm fully willing to let it go, because, like, he's in his car, second scene in the movie, and this shit hits me. I'm like, all right, I'm on board. We got a zombie apocalypse.
It is a good scene, I have to say, like, when they're in the car, and then the motorcycle policeman hits his window, and that, you know,
like,
shit
like
just...
knocks off his
Yeah, and
mirror.
Knocks off his mirror, and, like, shit just goes crazy. And that is a great scene, but it's so unclear. Like, are they fleeing the city at that moment, or are they just stuck in traffic?
I think he's driving
her
to school. Because he says something like, I might join my new job of driving you to school or something
like
that.
But it's so weird. Like, why? And, you know, traffic in cities is bad. But, you know, why is he driving her to school and there's all this traffic and, you know.
Oh, the transportation in Philadelphia is decent. He doesn't need a car.
Okay, anyway, moving on.
Like, actually, that was one of the things I was impressed. When I was watching this, like, oh, how did they film this? Like, they really went on set. Well, not on set, but they were like, film this through the streets of people running through Philadelphia. This actually must have been a lot of fun. But either way, so we're setting all this up, right? But then once they get on the Navy, it's a completely different movie. It's not an escape movie. It's not like a quasi-road movie. It's not like a survival movie. It's a completely different movie. And that's what gets so weird.
I wrote in my notes, his family is so, underlined, so unnecessary. Like, I don't even know why he has a family, because really the movie is about him trying to find a cure with this inept doctor who shoots himself within 5 seconds of them going on an adventure.
Apparently, I wish Goddard had worked on it. It would have been a lot more interesting. But Drew Goddard and Damon Lindelof, they inserted more family stuff so he had more roots.
Yeah, but who cares? I mean, in this sort of a situation,
yeah,
zombies are overtaking the world. We don't need roots. Like, everybody's a person. We all want the world to continue.
Yeah, like, if we got into such a misanthropic point where it's like, the entire human race might end, and you need to come up with motivation. Like, how about save the fucking human race? That's good enough for me. Like, I'm on board. I'm a human. I live on Earth. Like, you got me. Like, I don't need this thing of, oh, yeah, the entire human race is at stake, but give me some family shit.
Like, obviously, he has a family. We don't need... It's quite a long time into the film before they get to the Navy tanker thing. I think it's about half an hour in. And it's like, we just don't need his family. Like, it's so unimportant.
There is some weird parenting in this movie as well. There's some weird parenting and, like, husband-wife dynamics in this movie. Like, when they're talking...
Oh, don't go. I'm more important than saving the world from zombies.
Well, first of all, well, there's a few things. One is when they're talking about the current state of things, I believe she tells Brad Husband, like, take it outside. Like
the children did
just witness a
full-on zombie attack.
And we're going to, like, just keep them in the dark. Like, yeah, it's totally normal we're living on a Navy ship now. No big deal.
It's totally normal that we ran through a Newark apartment building and fought off zombies and your dad, like, you know, used a makeshift bayonet on some of them. Like, that's normal. It's
right,
fine.
Cool. So that we're not just trashing the movie, we should point out the second thing the movie did well, which is...
magazine armor on their arms.
Well, I can do that. I feel like I've seen that elsewhere.
Makeshift bayonet.
No, the thing is, Brad Pitt is fighting with the zombie, and he's like, ah, and the blood goes in his mouth, and he's like, and then he goes up to the roof, and he goes, I got it in my mouth, and he's counting 1,000, 2,000. And the idea is, like, if you've seen the movie, when they sort of become zombified, they start jerking. So it's not even that he would have to kill himself. He would just jerk and fall off the roof, if in fact he... So that was clever, except for a few things. One is, he never acts like that any other time, where he's like, ah, ah! He's never yelling.
That's the only time he's concerned that he has zombie blood in his mouth.
No, he's yelling before he knows about it. So he's yelling, like, he gets it in his mouth because he's yelling. He never yells like that when he's fighting them, the rest of the movie. So that's one. That's one aspect of, like, the problem with that scene.
I would like to talk about zombie turn time.
Okay.
Because in the book, when you are bitten by a zombie, you have possibly days before you reanimate as a zombie. And in fact, you get sick, you die, and then you reanimate. So, but in the film, you're bitten by a zombie, and then by the count to 12, a slow count to 12, granted, but by the time you count to 12, you are a zombie. And on the one hand, it's kind of interesting because cities could fall so quickly, but then it just seems to kind of take away the drama from everything, because anytime you're in the book, anytime you're in a place with other people, those people could be infected and you don't know it. Whereas here, they must have been bitten within 12 seconds. So the drama is kind of lost.
What also makes it seem insurmountable, and because like if people get bitten 12 seconds, then they're zombies. So like the zombie army, we'll call it that, just grows exponentially, like that.
Immediately.
Yeah. So it just seems like there's no way to defeat it, right? Whereas in the book, there's like all these, like I remember there's this story about this woman. Well, she was a girl at the time. And she talks about this woman they picked up and they brought in her car. And then, like, it becomes clear that she had her hand in her pocket, that she had a bite.
Yeah, she's a hitchhiker.
Actually, it was actually more interesting than that because it wasn't even clear she had a bite. They thought she might have
wiped. She had a bandage on her hand, and she had been keeping her hand in her pocket trying to find it.
And then, like, at the next rest stop, the people driving it just abandoned her. So we actually don't even know if she was infected or not, but that's just sort of the level of paranoia, you know, developing because people are so concerned about this.
On the subject of zombie turn time, once they get to the Navy aircraft carrier ship that they're on, one of the government officials says that airlines were the perfect delivery system, which actually makes no fucking sense. It makes perfect sense in the book where a person could be bitten and then they get on a plane.
Well, there's also this whole there's this whole explanation of people who deal in illegal organs in the book.
Yes. Yeah, that was very interesting as well. That you could get a zombie organ, possibly. In the movie, as the movie stands, if you were bitten by a zombie, within 12 seconds you'd be a zombie. So how would you get on a plane? You couldn't get on a plane. And then we have, I'm just jumping ahead to the Israel plane escape scene.
I know, you gotta go here. You gotta do it.
So, Israel plane escape scene. They're in a plane. They're going from Israel to Wales, which is fucking far. It is not like, you know, going from, I don't know, New York to Toronto.
Or someplace less far away from Israel than Wales.
Those places are far.
Yes.
I have not flown that leg, but I'm gonna assume it takes multiple hours.
I'm gonna assume it's usually not a direct flight.
I'm gonna assume
there's a Heathrow layover.
Okay, fair enough. But I'm gonna say that this is like more than 5 hours. Fair enough, more than 5 hours.
Right.
So that means let's just set the scene for people who might not have seen this part of the movie, although they'd be stupid to listen to our podcast. They're in the plane. In the plane.
I just want to say, it's our first podcast, and you're already calling people stupid.
Did I say stupid? No, I didn't say they're stupid. I said it would be stupid to listen to this if you hadn't seen the movie.
So if they listen to this and they haven't seen the movie, they're stupid.
Well, I'm not saying they're stupid, but it's not the best use of your time.
I would say it's not the best use of your time to watch this movie. So they might be smarter than us if they haven't seen this movie.
They're in the plane. They, you know, find their little nook, you know. Brad Pitt's attending to this Israeli soldier. Then they, like, are napping. A lot of time has passed. And then, all of a sudden, there's, like, a commotion in another part of the plane because a stewardess opens a door and there's a zombie inside of a closet. Or maybe it's a bathroom. I don't know. But whatever. If that person was a zombie the whole time, then that means they were just rattling around in this closet. And how did so many hours pass? Because they crash in Wales.
Yeah.
So that this must occur towards the end of the flight.
Well, I have to say a few things.
Where did this person come from? Either they've been begging around in a closet for the entire time and you would never open the door because obviously it would be a zombie, or they weren't banging around the entire time, which we have seen that zombies like to kind of bang into walls, make a little bit of noise when they're just hanging around. It just makes no fucking sense because if the turn time is so quickly, there's actually no way a zombie could get out.
I have a few things to say about this. This is annoying. As someone who hadn't read the book, on that flight, even though it made no sense, the movie had gotten to the point where, like, there's a zombie on this plane. Because everything up to this point had been a disaster. Every time people try to solve a problem related to zombies, they make it worse. For one, there's the series of ridiculous explosions that exist in this film. It starts in Philadelphia. It starts in Philadelphia.
Oh, can I just say one thing before you... I'm sorry.
So... This movie starts off with a series of unexplained explosions. When they're in Philadelphia, in complete and utter traffic, like, it's gridlocked, because there's some zombie thing going on, right? And a car inexplicably explodes, which is the first of a series of inexplicable explosions. So because they've developed this mood in the film where things just kind of explode when zombies are around...
Things could explode, because if a person... Let's say a person is driving, and then they turn into a zombie because somebody, like, kind of pulls them half out of the window, bites them, they turn into a zombie while driving, and then they could crash their car, and their car could explode.
But everyone's in gridlock. Where's the explosion?
I don't know.
Yeah, and then there's, like, throughout the movie, there's consistently unexplainable explosions. It kind of reminds me of that Simpsons cartoon where a car, like, rolls into a tree and then, like, stops and then, like, barely hits a tree and then explodes. Like, that's what this movie was like. It's all these unexplained explosions because that's exciting or something.
Can we talk about grenades on a plane?
We will talk about grenades on a plane, but I'm getting to a point with this explosion. There's a series of events of people try to solve things that make them worse. Like, in Israel, when the zombies get over the wall, which is really strange that no one's monitoring the wall. But
also, in the book, they talk about the ability of zombies to kind of, I don't know what term they use. Maybe they use the term stack, but they use some sort of terminology to say that zombies can kind of form a mound and get higher up. But in the book, they can't get that high. But yeah, why wouldn't there be somebody, like the way they have in a prison? You know, there's, like, a guard at the wall, like, looking at
but
it.
But, like, so at some point, well, not some point, when people do their celebratory song in Israel, and then, like, the zombies come over the wall because, like, they're drawn to loud sound, which is in the movie and not the book. Then, like, they're ravaging through. And then, like, apparently, even though they've built this wall, they've seemed to have built some safeguards because there's, like, sort of, like, grills over each street, right? So,
yes.
Like, even if you come from above, you can't come through. But then, like, some guy's getting, like, some IDF soldiers being eaten by zombies. So he pulls a grenade, explodes, but then it just makes, like, the roof cave in.
Then it makes a hole.
Yeah, and then they all start coming in through the roof. But there's a consistent thing of, like, this movie needs lots of explosions. But every time people try to do something, it always backfires. Which has this weird, unintended thesis, almost, to the movie of, like, the zombies succeed because they are selfless and socialist. Like, think about, like, them going over the wall, right? Like, no zombie cares who's on the body, right? They just all go towards their one goal, and then whoever gets on top goes over. So it's a completely selfless grouping.
Well, one thing I think that's very interesting about the book, a couple of times they talk about the zombies as an enemy, and why the zombies as an enemy are so successful. And it's like, they don't need any resources, they don't need food, they don't need air, they don't need anything. And there's one point where they talk about how they won't negotiate. They don't want anything. So you can't negotiate with them. You can't, like, find a peace treaty. You know, they're just going to keep coming at you until you kill them. And there's never been a war with an enemy like that. We are getting so over time, I think we should, like, think of some important things and then get to our next segment.
This movie makes no sense. And then the there's some very strange gender dynamics in this movie, for, in my opinion. Of like, A, both his daughters are useless. Because, like, one is scared, and one is...
They are children,
as
but okay.
Okay, but here's the point. Then there is Tommy, the boy from the family who takes them into the apartment. Like, when he goes off, the neighborhood's like, take care of these women. I'm like, hello? Or these girls, or something. I was like, hello? There is a 35-year-old... I don't know what she is. There's, like, a 35-year-old woman standing next to you. Like...
I think this is something you say to little boys to make them feel important.
Yeah, but, you know, there's, like, weird aspects of, like, masculinity in this movie.
Although, I wish there was a more badass female character. Considering... I don't remember her name, but the Israeli soldier. Considering that, one, she's an Israeli soldier, and I didn't have a number two, but she's an Israeli soldier. She should be a badass. I've met women from Israel who, because of the way things work in Israel, that they had to, you know, volunteer for the Israeli army.
Well, having to volunteer is called compulsory.
Whatever.
Everyone has to do 2 years in the Israeli army.
I have met Israeli women... They are fucking tough. You know, even if they're not, you know, tip, like, people who are going to stay in the army. Those are some badass chicks. And this woman had her head shaved, but she really, I wish she would have stepped up to the plate a little bit more and just been a fucking badass.
Well, it's already interesting, like, you actually don't have to shave your head to be...
Yes, you do
so
not need to do that.
The
That's
fact
true.
That they decided to shave her head is interesting, because...
But why isn't she more of a badass?
She does her business, but then she gets her hand cut off. And I find this interesting. This is what I mean by gender dynamics, right? When she gets her hand cut off, she is screaming like a banshee. Which I understand.
Gosh, her hand cut off,
No, but listen to this out. Because I would be doing the same, right? I'm sure it hurts. Then Brad Pitt, later in the film, is in a plane crash, survives, is impaled, and he's like this gruff, like, guy who gets on with it. It's just, I find it a interesting contrast, like, how he deals it versus the woman who's actually a professional soldier.
Well, you know who he is and what he does.
That's or so I've been told.
I agree. I wish the gender roles weren't so
okay. And so, and the movie decides he needs to take her with him. Like, he is running around, like, after the zombies have gone over the wall in Israel, right? Or I assume it's Tel Aviv, right? Probably the castle. So... And he escapes, and he decides he needs to take her, who has one hand now, because he cut off her hand because she got bit on the hand. Why does the movie decide he needs her?
Well, I don't think he needs her necessarily, but, you know, he's not going to ditch her.
No, but the movie makes a decision to take her with him, because he hasn't taken people with him up to this point. Like, we haven't even talked about the crazy scene where, like, he talks to a CIA guy, or ex-CIA guy, who sold secrets or guns to the North Korea Republic. Tells him a whole bunch of shit, uncorroborated, and then, like, believes him. And then, like, oh, yeah, I'm going
but
to... That's why he
that
goes to Israel.
Oh, that's why he goes to Israel.
Yeah, remember, because he's like, you got to talk to this guy in Israel. I'm like, why do you believe this guy? He has no corroborating evidence.
Well, I wondered why he had to be
this is
in
why
jail.
The movie is, what do you call it, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego video game.
All right, let's just move on. I'm just going to generally mention some things. When he puts together the flimsy theory... That the zombies don't attack people who are suffering from serious ailments.
No. He thinks are terminal.
Like a man's limp.
Yeah.
In South Korea.
If someone who's good enough to be in the U.S. Army, I'm not exactly sure what branch, but has a limp, and the zombies avoid him.
Yeah, ooh, the bait.
Which is really kind of an example of just self-hating zombies, because they're kind of limpers.
Well... I have to say, I think it's very offensive to those people who have limps. It is in no way a serious medical...
It's not terminal.
Yeah, it's not terminal, and it's very easy to live with, you know, and probably not the most comfortable thing, but they could deal with it. When he's telling that theory, there's, like, this terrible voiceover from the doctor who accidentally shot himself in the head.
Completely
which is ridiculous.
Nonsensical. Scene. Like, we have this doctor who's like, might be able, and shoots himself within 5 minutes of being grounded. Maybe 3 minutes?
It was just
why
like,
do you have that scene?
Oh, seriously? He's just shot himself. It was just so flimsy.
Yeah, what's the point? Why not have him taken out by a zombie?
Yeah, that would be so much easier and make so much more sense. But it's almost like we have to prove that intellectuals are useless.
But I almost wonder, is this the point that, like, Brad Pitt has the on-the-ground knowledge? He's like, don't keep your finger on the trigger. And clearly he must have when he tripped and killed himself.
Ah, that was just ridiculous.
Awful.
But when he's putting together his very flimsy theory, which, you know, he doesn't know that those people are sick. You know, he doesn't know. I still, you know, that guy with a limb, I don't know that that's enough to make a zombie not want to kill you. But there's this, like, very bad voiceover, and it's just so cheesy. Just needed to mention
also,
that.
Also, I like the fact that the zombies, not only do they avoid terminal people, they specifically get out of their way. Like, when they're rampaging through, and there's, like, the sick kid.
Yeah, like, they don't want to catch anything.
Yeah, and the old man. They specifically get out of the way. These people who will pile on each other, these zombies, to go over walls. They'll, like, just run at anything. Like, but like, oh, no, excuse me, sick child. No, like, oh, pardon me. Like, they just, like, get out of the way. Like, this kid literally bends down on the street, and no zombie touches him. Not even, like, brushes up against him.
Can we talk about grenades on a plane?
All right.
Grenades on a plane. For our listeners out there, I just want to advise you that before you set off a grenade on a plane, maybe you should buckle your seatbelt first. They actually throw a grenade into the plane, and they take no precautions. They don't buckle their seatbelts first. They don't get their little air masks on. They just throw a fucking grenade into a plane and hope that that's not going to kill them as well.
Well, there was a weird thing where the zombie virus, I guess the bite, because of the weird closet thing, attacks coach first. And it's like this weird, almost metaphor for, like, first class and, like, coach going about their business in first class, like, quietly stacking these suitcases as a trap, which I don't understand why that's going to work. That's going to bite you 5 seconds. But,
well, I guess it is, if they were super quiet, the zombies wouldn't feel the need to go past the suitcases.
But here's the problem. And this is what the movie is once he gets airlifted. The movie is a series of events where people try to be really quiet, and then someone drops something, steps on something, kicks on something, and they make a noise, and zombies... Like, that happens over and over again. We're really quiet, we make a noise, uh-oh, the zombies hear us, and we're dead.
I don't have a problem with that.
It gets a little tiring.
But I just think that if you're going to throw a grenade in a plane, buckle your seatbelt first. Can we talk about the World Health Organization?
Let's at least keep chronological. The plane crashes, because they threw a grenade, and that makes sense. Of course, Brad Pitt and his companion are the only people that survive on the flight. And this guy's really riding his luck so far. Because he's been in probably more zombie fights than anyone, and he's alive. Yeah, he's been speared by some piece of metal that's went through his side. I'm a little confused. Like,
it's just a flesh wound.
Yeah, just a flesh. I'm a little confused by what his Israeli comrade did, because she was seated next to him.
Yeah, and then she's like gone.
Yeah, and there's supposed to be this idea of, like, he's like, oh, wakes up, she's not there, like, oh no, she's gone. Like, oh, he has metal in him. I understand this element of, like, oh, she's gone. Oh, wait, no, she's back. But then, like, she's just, like, wandering around, like, yeah, I just thought I'd let him sleep. You know, he has, like, a piece of metal inserted in him, but I let him do his thing.
Yeah, I mean, she couldn't have fallen out of her chair because she had her seatbelt on. So it makes no sense. But let's move on to, they go through Cardiff, luckily, has no zombies on the street.
Well, luckily, they crashed within walking distance as well.
That too, yeah. So it's good when you crash walking distance.
Yeah, actually, I have to wonder, did they crash actually closer than the Cardiff Airport? Did they actually benefit from the crash?
I'd be really lucky, because it's so hard to get a decent...
I've never been to the Cardiff Airport. I'm assuming it's a bit of a distance from the city center.
I just assume that Wales is one town. So they go through the town. There are no zombies on the street. Apparently, people still live in their homes and look through their
curtains. Well, it's fortunate there's no zombies here because he's limping. It's good that this is the one place there aren't zombies.
But there are zombies inside the World Health Organization.
But there probably are also zombies generally in Cardiff because there's a milk delivery crate that's been spilled.
But that's the only sign of any sort of struggle. The rest
well,
of the town...
Well, what about the paranoia in the woman's eyes as she looks through the window?
Yeah, she might just be nosy. The rest of the town really has... It's in very good shape, considering how many explosions there were in the city.
There are no unexplained explosions in Cardiff.
Brad Pitt wakes up inside the World Health Organization, and these guys are super mad at him. Even though he's obviously not a zombie.
And it's incredibly suspicious. This is where we're going to bring it back to 28 Days Later. Because this is the act that was rewritten. Because apparently the original act is like some big scale battle, zombie battle in Russia. But I guess they've done a number of battles, so they're not well done in this movie. So like, oh, we can't do this. So then there's the tense thing. But I almost wonder if they're trying to, like, evoke 28 days later, because, like, he, like, cause
when
that,
he wakes up.
Yeah, because there's thing of, like, 28 days, well, there's that, but there's also 28 days later is they think they finally have made it, because they, with the army, and then it turns out to be his own nightmare, and that's really horrible, too, like, oh, like, because, like, they're going to rape the woman, I'm going to spoil 28 days
later. Yeah, spoilers for 28 days later.
Like, if you haven't seen 28 days later. That's what I was wondering, is it trying to evoke 28 days, like, oh, they're really suspicious, there's something going on here. But there's, like, no need for, A, he's tied down to his bed, right?
But he's so obviously not a zombie,
yeah.
Because it's been more than 12 seconds.
Yeah. So
and the Israeli's woman is there. They
but,
could
but,
talk to her.
Well, apparently she's really put on a good soldier face, because she's not giving them any information over the last 3 days, because they don't know who he is, what he's doing, why he's there.
But they're not mean to her. I mean, it just makes no fucking sense.
But clearly she gave them no information in the 3 days. Like, they're just hanging out, and she's like, yeah, I'm not telling you nothing. And it's, and just to be clear, it's not an issue of English. She speaks English. It's not
yes,
like
it's
she
not,
only speaks Hebrew.
Thank you for clearing that up, because I was wondering if it was just a misunderstanding or a cultural faux pas.
I'm just trying to say, in case people haven't seen the movie, like, it's not a case that she doesn't speak English. In fact, she seems to have even lost her accent in the crash, which is tragic.
So,
post-crash.
Here's, like, a very overdone movie thing when someone asks another character, do you have a family? Because Brad Pitt asks one of the...
Because if you don't, you're shit. You're
scum. Well, I mean, there's been a zombie apocalypse, you know, and he's asking this guy who works at the WHO if he has a family, like, as if, one, other people don't have families, even if you don't have children.
You can't wrap your mind around a zombie apocalypse unless you have a family.
Well, unless you have children, is what he's really saying, because everyone has a family. Like, everyone has people who are important to them, whether it's their parents or their nieces.
Is this the time to confess I'm actually a test tube baby and I don't have a family?
I mean, unless this WHO worker was, like, raised by wolves, he has a fucking family. You know, and, like, Brad is like, do you have a family? Like, as if he's the only person on Earth who has a family that he's concerned
like,
about.
Like, don't you get it, man?
That really annoyed me. You know, unless maybe this guy is a sociopath and doesn't have human relations the
yeah.
way most of us do.
Like all eggheads.
Yeah. He.
But then he says, like, oh, I have a son. And he got zombified. Or a little more exposition than that.
I like the idea of using zombie as a verb.
Yeah, so it's like, my son was zombified. And then Brad's like, I'm sorry. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
It's like, oh, I'm sorry. I forgot
sorry.
That other people have lives and stories.
It's like, I'm sorry. When I was a dick to you, I didn't realize it was because you had a son. Like, had I known you were a son, I would have been as much of a dick.
But obviously this man has some sort of family. He's living inside the WHO building. Like, there must be other people that are important to him. So, I have to say, one thing I thought that was good about this film was a scene, or the scenes, when they go into B-Wing to try to get the diseases that he's going to inject himself with to see if his theory works. I actually thought that was a very tense scene, and cinematically it played out well. It is not in the book, but I did enjoy the B-Wing scenes.
I think it would have been a lot better if we didn't already have so many scenes where people are trying to be quiet, and then there's a noise. Because this is part of the thing of, in this movie, Women Are Useless, is like when they're doing the bicycling scene to get their fuel. Like,
why are their bikes so creaky?
Well,
they're really creaky bikes.
Because they haven't been used recently. But like,
no, oil
which is actually different than
bikes.
The book, where it makes a point of bikes become the main form of transportation in the post-zombie world.
Well, it also makes sense in the books that bikes would be the form of transportation, since the zombies in the books are not fast moving.
Yeah. And they don't require fuel. But there's a scene earlier, and then like Brad Pitt has his super phone, which seems to always run out of energy, but then somehow gets your charge.
Yeah, just magically recharged that phone.
But like, and his wife calls him while he's trying to escape, which of course ends up killing tons of people, but that's women are useless in this movie.
I have no problem with that, because she might want to call him, but the problem I have is that when he answers the phone, he doesn't say, don't call this phone. Because she could very easily call the phone again and kill people again.
He doesn't say, never call me.
Yeah, baby,
call
don't call this phone. I will call you.
Can we also say, it's a little obnoxious that given the precious resources that are left in the world, he has to call his wife every day.
You know what? In a zombie apocalypse, I'd like you to call me every day.
Yeah, that's not going to happen when I have finite battery life. First
who else are you going to call?
Well, first of all, given
your... Are you calling other people?
First of all, you're going to be one of the first to go because of your allergies.
Are you saying that I'm going to have a stress-induced asthma attack?
You're going to have panic asthma. And you're going to be done for.
Aw, thanks.
I'm just laying it out.
He's in B-Wing. He finds the area that he needs to find. He doesn't have the codes. And yet, there's, like, really no reason for the codes. There could have just been a button you push. But he doesn't have the codes. The scientist calls him. Then he hangs up the fucking phone. Why not keep that phone on the hook so that you could speak again and not worry about sound?
Well, here's the problem, right?
Or why not get some instructions? Like, oh, you're on the phone? This is really useful because I lost the other scientist guy. Could you tell me which ones I'm supposed to take?
I actually like the thing where he's about to smash the window, the door, and then the scientist calls him. Okay, so that's the third thing in this movie that's good. And she gives him the code, right? And then he goes in, and he leaves the crowbar by the side, which wouldn't have really mattered anyway. He leaves the crowbar so we know that he's completely unarmed. Like, earlier on, he lost his axe, but it completely made sense because he put it in a doorway so that the door wouldn't squeak so the zombies wouldn't hear. So we got that. But, like, he just leaves outside, which is dumb. Like,
he should have left it. There's one point where he's, like, beating a zombie,
yeah,
and the crowbar is stuck. I think cinematically, it was tense. He was trying to get the crowbar out, and he can't get out.
The guy's
like
strong.
And he should have just like had to give up there. That would have been a perfect place to give up your crowbar,
yeah,
even
because
though you really
need a crowbar when you don't need two hands to use the number pad. But then he goes in. A zombie comes
maybe
out.
Maybe he's
door.
Not a good type.
The zombie comes. I was like, oh, you don't have your crowbar. Oh, you're stuck in here. And so he has to decide. He writes on a pad like and holds up to the camera because there's a camera in there that the other people who work there can see. It's like, tell my family I love them. Like, oh, okay. They had no idea. Because they just thought you abandoned them because you were, like, all into zombies.
Well,
like
in, what world? Like, let's say everyone survives somehow, and they call his family. Like, oh, yeah, you know, he died trying to find a cure. Like, oh.
And he was fucking a zombie.
Did he send any last-minute messages saying that he loved us? Because I really, you know, we've been on this Navy ship, and I was really mad that he left, and I just don't understand if he loved us or if he was just trying to save the world.
And I thought, like, okay, he can write. We're going to do something like he's going to write to the camera and be like, because the whole point is there's all these terrible diseases in there, right? And he's going to, because the whole thing is...
Are they not labeled?
They're labeled, but I'm sure I wouldn't know. Right? But the idea is he's going to inject himself with one because he has this theory that if you make yourself sick, the zombies won't get you. So he's going to put one disease in him, and then it's going to be like camouflage. So he has all these diseases, and like most of them will kill him. So he has this pad, he has his camera, and there's this phone.
I'm thinking
he's going to write, like, since he wrote the pad, he's going to write on the pad and be like a vial to the camera that I should inject in me, ring on the phone. Right? I thought that's why we set up that whole phone thing. Holds up the sign, doesn't do it. And it's not like he's left the phone off the hook or something, which would make sense because he wants to avoid the noise of a ring because it could make sure a zombie doesn't come. No, he just randomly picks one and it turns out to work. Because he's been right. I mean, he survived the plane crash. Why not keep riding your luck?
The thing is, there are actually not many diseases that have a cure. Like, most diseases don't actually have a cure. So most of
the
just
good news is they keep the cure back in the office where the people
are. Yeah, in the other office.
Yeah, they have a sick office and then they have a cure office, and the cure office doesn't have any zombies near it, so it works out well. Though, I suppose in all fairness, Brad Pitt could have walked to where that is. Because
you're right, that's not an issue because now he is safe. All right, I think we have sufficiently shared why we dislike this movie.
Okay, so should we go to the ADHD theater for some haiku reviews?
Oh, yes. Okay, so, you know, us being writers and all that, we have decided that
And, you know, if you don't have time to read a book, you can watch the movie. But if you don't have time to watch the movie, you can just watch the trailer. But if you don't even have time to watch the trailer, that's what haiku review comes in.
I will go first. I have two, but I'm going to choose the one that's a better summary of the film. It's a better review.
Or has put more thought into this than I have.
Yeah, I know. I with most things. Reanimated. Is it rabies or zombies? A cure in 2 weeks.
I think 2 weeks might be generous. I was tempted to
Well, he says that it started a week earlier, so I'm going to give him a week for...
I was tempted to actually look up the flight times that the movie's involved in. Like, no, like, you know, like off the Atlantic Ocean to South Korea, South Korea to Israel, Israel to Cardiff, and like figure out how long
that
is.
They're long flights. Those are all long flights.
Yeah, but they're all less than 24 hours.
But still, I mean, that's at least like 2 days of travel, let's just say.
Okay. Right. Here's my haiku. Expert on the ground. Not clear what Brad Pitt's job is. Family before world.
So that wraps up our episode of Now a Major Motion Picture Podcast.
All right, so what are we doing for next episode?
Well, we had thought that it would be nice to do Catching Fire, but before we talk about Catching Fire, it only makes sense to do the first Hunger Games book and movie. So that's what we'll be discussing in our next episode. If you would like to hear more of our episodes, you can go to our website, nammp.blogspot.com. That stands for Now a Major Motion Picture. And you can always write to us at nowamajormotionpicture@gmail.com.
All right, until then, gut up.
Gut up. Night of the living dead, at last, they have begun to shake the dirt, wiping their shoulders from the earth. I know.